So scholars generally agree that this story of Jesus' temptation is a theological one, not necessarily a historical one. It doesn't make it less true, just that it tells us something true about who we are and who God is, instead of something true about an event in time. I think that's a helpful framework, because it pulls us out of our fascination with the devil, right? It's hard to read this passage and not be trying to process in your mind what you believe about the devil, who you think the devil might be. Maybe you're picturing Satan crawling out of hell with sulfur and fire hanging off him to confront Jesus in the wilderness. But I want to invite you this morning to think a little more figuratively about the reality of evil and temptation in the world. One of the ways that scholars deduce that this passage is not necessarily historical is to analyze the qualities that are given to the devil, who's here given the blame for tempting Jesus. Some say the writer was placing the Roman Emperor Caligula in the place of the tempter, or Satan, or the devil, all different translations. Others say it had to be the Jewish client king, Herod Agrippa. Both would have been very good faces to put to evil in the mid to late first century. It's a human tendency to personify evil and blame someone else for suffering, for bad situations in our life and in our world. In this political climate, most of us could pretty quickly, don't say it out loud, please, we're not going to go there, but you can pretty quickly conjure up an image of a particular Republican or Democrat to place in that seat of blame, and maybe even to label with one of those names. I don't know. Our Genesis text invites us to place blame as well. Adam blames Eve, Eve blames the serpent. While all of those are human urges to blame, they fall apart when we look at them with any scrutiny. Maybe you, like me, are particularly sensitive to the brand of belief that blames the temptress, Eve, for all of the sin and evil in the world. Does anybody like feel like as a woman that might be a little bit of a heavy burden to carry? It is one of the burdens of patriarchy and sexism that suggests that somehow men fall apart and everything goes to hell in a handbasket if there's a woman around. It's actually not a very complimentary perspective on men as well as women. And you know better if you've ever raised an 8-year-old boy, right? Or spent any time around a fraternity, or watched the movie Deliverance. Remember that, oldie but goodie? Men can mess things up just fine on their own. But we like to place blame. And for some reason, we rarely place it on the shoulders that can bear it, and perhaps even invite it, those of God. After all, God was the one that placed Adam and Eve in the garden and gave them everything that they needed, and apparently one thing that they didn't, the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. They were told that it was the one thing that they couldn't eat. Seems like surrounding a 12-year-old with like greens and milk and vitamins and eggs and all kinds of vegetables and good hearty meat, all the things that will help her to live long and be strong and resilient, and then placing a beautiful birthday cake in the center of it with glowing candles and a knife and fork and saying, do whatever you want, it's all yours, my child, except don't eat the cake. It seems to me that God can shoulder a little bit of the blame for what happened in the Garden of Eden. After all, God created it. And we read in the temptation story that Jesus was led into the wilderness by the Spirit. And yet we find a million ways to blame anybody but God for what happened there. It's fascinating to me that piece in the Lord's Prayer that reads, "Lead us not into temptation." It's almost as if Jesus was like teaching us to pray that prayer and at the same time had one eye on God going, like, seriously, Father, I've been there. Don't do it to them too. Come on. But somehow when we pray that, we actually expect it to fully happen, that we would never have to face evil or suffering or difficult or impossible choices. It feels perhaps like a little bit of blasphemy somehow to blame God for evil, for temptation, for suffering. So just bear with me and sit with it for a moment. Blaming God, it seems to me, is a little like when my daughter blames me for her empty gas tank. Other parents pay for gas, Mom. Why can't you? And I just always answer, honey, that's the deal that we have. But I think to myself, seriously? Like, I bought that car for her. I pay the insurance. I taught her how to drive it. I fastened the license plate on it myself. I got it all registered and set up. I take it to get oil changes when she comes home. I sent her to school in the car to expand her world. Her car allows her to get to her internship and a part-time job and home to me. All the things that will nurture and strengthen and empower her. But I get it. I'd love for somebody to pay for my gas, too. And paying for her gas is clearly within my means, and I don't do it. I'm not willing to take that bullet. I am the one to blame. I accept that. I think somehow it's like that. God has broad, powerful shoulders. Way broader, obviously, than mine. God also is in charge of the world. Created the world, loved the world, and in the process placed the tree in the garden, tempting Adam and Eve. The Spirit led Jesus into the wilderness to be tempted, and God allows us to be confronted by evil and temptation in the world, even while knowing that much of the time we're slaves to sin, unable to make good, healthy, right choices on our own. But the thing is, God doesn't leave us alone or without resources. We have power that we don't always acknowledge. Adam and Eve were tempted by the serpent in the garden, who told them that if they ate of the fruit of the forbidden tree, they would become like God. But here's the thing. It seems to me they were already like God. They weren't God. But they were like God. They were created in the image of God. They were living in harmony and community with God. They were given everything they needed by God. They just didn't use their God-given gifts and power to navigate the difficult reality of sin that existed even in the Garden of Eden. Many of you know that my full-time gig is as a hospital chaplain in Columbus. One of my primary roles there is to help patients and families make difficult decisions about chronic life-changing disease. So regularly, we ask things like, should I get a feeding tube or start dialysis or stop dialysis? Should I try a new cancer treatment or begin hospice care? Should we decline CPR if Dad's heart stops? Should we remove Mom's ventilator or prepare her to live the rest of her life in a long-term care facility? They are impossible questions that no one should have to ask, and no one should have to answer. The doctors give patients and families all of the medical information that they have, sometimes not all that they wish they had, but they give them all that they know so they can make a sound clinical medical decision. Social workers and care managers help with sorting out the practical details of the decision, how much it'll cost, where it'll take place, who will be there. And my job is to identify and corral all of the spiritual resources a particular individual may have and determine how they influence that decision. and help them to use not only their medical knowledge that's been given to them, the practical skills that they have to gather family and navigate that decision, but their spiritual resources as well. So the question I find myself asking in some form or fashion almost every day in my job is, how does what you know about yourself and the world and the people you love and the God or the power that you serve, how do all of those things that create meaning and belief and love in your life, how do they serve to inform this decision? How are you going to use those things? How are you going to use your faith to make this decision? I love that question. It's one I rarely ask so overtly in the church. How does your faith affect your life and your decision-making about your life? It's a strange thing, isn't it? We don't ask that question. Maybe it's assumed. We just don't ask that question a lot in the world, in the church. In the hospital, there's a million different brands and traditions and spiritual perspectives that folks have, so it can get interesting. There are no universally right or wrong answers to those specific questions about medical care, only ones that are right or wrong for a particular person and who they understand themselves to be. Our text for today tell us something about who we are as children of God. On first glance, you might come to one of two logical and contrasting conclusions. The first is, we are powerless in the face of temptation. After all, Jesus overcame it, but we are not Jesus. We are in bondage to sin, to use Paul's words. So all we can do is pray and hope that we will never have to make difficult decisions or be confronted by evil or tempted by instant gratification or the promise of power or to worship something aside from the one true God. Second, the other kind of side of that coin is the outcome that we might come to if we think that what this passage tells us is that we can overcome evil on our own. After all, Jesus did. And Jesus, we profess, was fully human. So we just need to try harder or be better or pray longer or live more faithfully. But to limit ourselves only to those options, those extreme contrasting options, discounts the power of God in the person of Jesus. These stories about temptation seem to be about the ways in which we are human, but also, and perhaps ultimately, they're about the way that God is God and the way that Jesus is God. Those were important things to know when the gospel was being written in first century Palestine, where early Christians had quite a lot of explaining to do if they were going to claim Jesus as their Messiah. Since things hadn't turned out at all the way that people, at least the Jewish people, were expecting them to when Messiah came. There was no political redemption of Israel. There was no inauguration of the Messianic age where all would live in harmony with full bellies and safe shelter. There was no universal proclamation to the world about God's love and will for it, at least at that point. The stories had yet to be written down. And really, if you think about it, only a relative few had seen or heard Jesus. That handful of people who lived in the particular part of Galilee where he preached and taught and healed, or those who happened to be in Jerusalem for the Passover in the right place at the right time on that particular fateful year that he was crucified. There was a lot of explaining to do because Jesus, the Messiah, the Son of God, didn't completely look the way that people were expecting. But God doesn't seem to do things the way that humans might. I don't know why. I don't know why God allows evil in the world, or why we are led into temptation, or why God seems to so often miss delivering the ones that need delivering the most. But what I see today in the text is that God doesn't compromise. God doesn't give up what God has claimed for each of us in the person of Jesus and what was given to us before time, our creation in the image of God. We are powerless to face temptation and evil and suffering and to fix it on our own. If we could have, it would have been done a long time ago, because people have been dealing with those realities for all of time. But thanks be to God, we're not alone. We are given power that we so often discount in our tendency to place blame and avoid making difficult decisions. We're given grace when we make wrong decisions. And because Jesus has already won the battle over evil, we are given infinite freedom. All of those decisions we make, they're really just working out the details. Jesus has already claimed and saved and redeemed us. How does your faith, how does what you know about God and yourself and this world affect the way you live your life and the decisions you make? The best answer I ever got in the hospital to that question was, "You know what, chaplain? It makes me unafraid. I can't get this wrong." Brothers and sisters, God has got this. God has shown us once again in our text for today that God doesn't compromise, that the way that God lives and moves in the world is not the way we do, but luckily, thankfully, we are empowered by God. Let us be bold in living into these precious, powerful lives of faith that we have been given. Let us be unafraid to use our God-given power. And let us know now and for always, for good and for bad, for Jesus' sake and because of his love, in suffering and rejoicing, when we get things wrong and when we fail miserably, and when we get things right, even in the face of evil, in life and in death, we belong to God. Amen.